matters so that they would make sense to them. They aren't as consistent as crows. Rank and alliances change among humans all the time, inside the flock and outside. And if you hurt one of their kin, they'll punish whole families, even whole towns. You are here to help me, and I am here to keep the Balitang nestlings alive all summer, yes? Nawat smiled. Yes, Ali. Then you must trust me when I say that mobbing the prince would place them in even more danger, Ali told him, now feeling weak and peculiar. She wondered if Aunt Day never felt this way, and if being able to speak animal languages made times like this easier for her aunt. If we are vigilant with the nestlings, if we never let them stray from our eyes, we can hold them safe without mobbing anyone. She rubbed her forehead, which had begun to ache. Will you tell your friends, Nawat? She asked. And I will explain to you about humans and royalty later. Yes, Ali, Nawat told her with that particularly sweet smile. It was a smile that could divert her attention from Kiprioth's wager, so she thrust all thought of it from her mind and went to collect her goats. She was leading them through the village gates when she heard the crows take flight from the castle. For a while she turned and walked backward to see the birds soar above Tanair, delighting at the sight of their iridescent blue-black feathers in the early light and the graceful sweep of their wings. Soon they were gone, some to the trees among the eastern rocks, others to the fields that supported Tanair. She only hoped they hadn't left large, white, streaky signs of their presence for the household to find when they went outside. Ali walked on, savoring the fresh morning air and the promise of warmth to come. The weather here was nearly perfect, warm to hot days and cool nights. She walked among fields that showed signs of crops coming in, down roads lined with wildflowers and the occasional tree. There were worse places to spend the summer, she decided as she led the goats into the rocks about the Damari Road. With Bronow's presence to keep her alert and with the understanding that Kiprioth would not have trouble to involve Ali and the crows if he'd anticipated a peaceful summer, she knew she could pass a few interesting, pleasant months here. She did like a challenge. Ali settled the goats in the rocks above the road to Damari. Once they were happily grazing, she sat to peel the casing from her morning's cold sausage. Kiprioth, she called teasingly, I'll share my breakfast with you. Spare me. The god appeared atop a nearby boulder, dressed as a Ra-Ka with his usual scrambled collection of jewelry and sparkling ornaments. He sat casually, his arms looped around one bent knee so the jewels in his bracelets caught the morning sun. Sausage has no appeal for me whatever. Ali sighed. It's cooked, silly. Kiprioth turned his face into the wind. Cooked or raw, sausage is not the food of the gods. Why are we talking? My brother and sister won't stay occupied with other wars forever, you know. Ali examined her fingernails as if she weren't interested in her next question. Are you looking to start a war here, sir? Kiprioth grinned, white teeth flashing against brown skin. It was a grin that was the essence of mischief, with none of the sweetness of Nawat's smile. A fine effort and well executed. May I remind you that you never call me sir? Ali grimaced. Tiny slips like that betrayed an impersonation. Why should you care? The god went on. You have but one task between now and the autumn equinox, to keep the Balitang children alive. War isn't a concern for you. Ali leaned back against a tree, her eyes on the goats rather than the god. You see, that's what I wanted to ask you about, she explained in her friendliest manner. It's just that I worry Chenaol will believe I'm here for a bit longer than the summer. I would hate to disappoint her when I go. She might even believe that you might keep me here. Oh, no. I will do nothing of the kind, Kiprioth said. I doubt that Chenaol takes it that way. Ali sat up on her knees and looked at the god. Good, she said. A wager is sacred in the divine realms. Anyone knows it. If you try to change the terms we've agreed to, I'll bring the matter before your fellow gods, including the two whose attention you least want to draw. The two who kicked you off your throne. Don't even think of pulling the wool over my eyes. He vanished from his rock to reappear in front of Ali. The thought never crossed my mind, he said and kissed her on the forehead. A wager's a wager. He vanished, making the air pop where he had been. Ali shook her head, then stood and stretched. I should feel relieved, she mused aloud. And yet, Somehow I don't. She dozed for a while in the sun. When she woke, it was to a crow's announcement of riders on the road south from Tener. Ali sharpened her sight and saw a noble riding party below her. Prince Bronow, Duke Mequin, Duchess Winamine, Sarai, and Dove were out riding. The prince called a mocking challenge, which Sarai accepted with a whoop, nudging her horse into a gallop as the prince spurred his own mount. They thundered down the southern road, Sarai like a warrior out of legends, her hair springing from its pins. Two bodyguards followed the racers at the gallop, while Mequin, Winamine, Dove, and their guards kept to a lively trot. They waved to Ali, who waved back as they rode on. Ali stretched out her leg tendons, touching her toes as she turned things over in her mind. Did Bronow think Sarai might be a bride for him? The prince was a younger son, which meant his pockets might not be very deep. Did he think Sarai had money? Through enthusiastic eavesdropping, Ali had discovered that Ballytongue's inherited by Luaran law. Elsrin would get the bulk of the duke's lands and wealth at his death. Sarai and Dove would split their inheritance from their mother, Tener and a few other small estates. They would not be wealthy brides. She heard footsteps, quiet but not noiseless, among the rocks to her left. Ali bent casually and picked up two of a small pile of stones she had made before her nap. Back at home, she had learned to throw rocks from the village boys until she could kill rabbits or dent heavy wood with the force of her throw.
"She rides well, our Sarai."
Ulasim stepped out from between the rocks. Ali looked him over. Today he wore homespun and moved as easily in the rough garments as her own father moved in his clothes. Ali noticed something else. The outlines of dagger sheaths against his sleeves and on his breeches where they fell over his calf-high boots. Ulasim hadn't worn blades before. "She does ride well," Ali said. "I suppose you've talked to Chenaol?"
"Of course," said Ulasim. "We're all in this together."
"This," Ali said musingly, guessing that he spoke of the conspiracy among the Balitang Raka. "Tell me, did you ever want to put Sarugani on the throne?" Ulasim shook his head.
"The time wasn't right."
After a moment's hesitation, he added,
"And she wasn't right. More heart than head. When everyone knows the head is what matters when dealing with the Luaran, it matters, too, that she had no royal blood through the Luaran line, which will bring more of the Part Ra'ka to our cause. Our lady has the Ritavan blood as well as the ancient Haiming blood, and she is wiser than her mother. The people will love Sarai as queen."
He fell silent for a moment, then said,
"We have waited a very long time for this. We shall have only one chance. If we fail, the Luaran will see to it that we cannot rise again. That is why so many came to see her. They know what is at stake. They have prayed for this chance for generations."
The head hostler, Lokage, rode up on Duke Mequin's hunter. The old Ra'ka used no saddle, Ali realized, and no bridle. Her estimation of the tiny man rose several notches. She would have shrunk from riding such a big horse with full tack, let alone with none. Lokage dismounted easily and set the horse among the goats to graze. Then he lay down atop a rock, apparently there just to bask in the sun. Ulasim picked up a stick and whittled on it. It seemed they were waiting. Ali put her rocks back in their pile and practiced head and handstands on the soft grass. She had just progressed to walking on her hands when Chenaol arrived through the rocks, panting from the exercise.
"I told them," she informed Ali as she collapsed beside the girl.
"I noticed," Ali said with a grin. "Who else did you tell?"
"Fezgau," replied Chenaol, fanning herself with one hand. "Veron's got him in charge of the watch today, and he dares not leave."
Somehow, Ali wasn't surprised to hear that Fezgau was part of the conspiracy. She hesitated for a moment, then shrugged. "Time to get my feet wet," she thought, and said, "Veron is the king's spy. He keeps his papers and coding materials in a box set on the lintel over his door. Have you someone who can watch him and intercept any reports he might try to send out? Not Fezgau. He's too obvious."
"One of my stable boys will do well at such work," said Lokage. "Boys are less obvious than men, and these boys are forever trailing behind the men-at-arms when I've no work for them. It will be easy."
"Should we tell his grace?" asked Ulasim.
Ali shook her head.
The Duke and the Duchess do not need to know, she replied. I will tell them when it is necessary. Locage turned his head to stare at her.
They listen to you? He asked, plainly startled. But they only know you as a slave.
Ali grinned. Your friend appeared to them as Mithros and told them to listen to me, she explained. They think I'm his messenger.
That explains.
Chenaul's voice trailed off as she considered what this information did explain.
Fezgau said that you suggested he check the forest for bandits on the way here, Ulasim remarked. He wasn't sure if there were people abroad having been in the city so long, but you convinced him.
Ali shrugged.
Well,
Chenaul said, more pleased than she had been the previous night.
Things should go better now that we have a proper spy. We're ready for anything.
Anything but a mage, Ali pointed out, lying back and linking her hands behind her head. As clouds scuttled by, she added, The healer Rihani is good only for healing, and only a certain amount of it at that. A true mage come here on King Oran's behalf could crack us wide open. Speaking of the king, Locage leaned over and spat to one side.
Satisfying, but not useful, Ali said. If spit made a difference, you, Rakar, would have had the Isles back as soon as everyone got to know the Luaran. With regard to the king, if he has one of his bad twitches, Varon and his boys won't be enough to hold off a royal assault. And you can't count on Varon. Like as not, he'll just open the Tanair gates like a good dog. Have you, Rakar, made your own provisions for warriors, patrols of the plateau? If outsiders infiltrate this area, you should stop them before they reach Tanair.
But why? Ulasim wanted to know. Surely it is enough to retreat to the castle. We're safe inside the walls.
Ali shook her head. If they trap us in the castle, then we are well and truly trapped, she explained. It would be far better for any assassins the king sends to vanish before they reach Tanair. That way, when the king asks what happened to his soldiers, his grace can say, What soldiers? Without even needing to lie. What he doesn't know won't hurt him. Locage whistled.
Make the king's warriors vanish if they come. What a deceitful turtle dove you are.
Ali smiled at the sky. Oh, don't, she replied in the tones of a flirtatious court lady.
Stop, I insist. Your flattery makes me blush.
Have we the warriors? Asked Chenaul slowly.
Locage cleared his throat. When the other Raka looked at him, he raised his eyebrows. They nodded. The old hostler turned his eyes on Ali.
There are some fighters up here waiting, he explained. In the villages, over the last 3 years they have come, young men and women, nearly 60 in all, to train and to wait. The elders will be happy the time has come to put them to use. They hunt, they fight, and they flirt with their daughters and sons.
He smiled.
They are also very good at riding, scouting, shooting, and building walls. They have their own mounts and can live in the open air.
The crows will help, said a voice from nearby. Nawat had come up soundlessly to stand near Boulder.
We will teach your fighters as we taught Ali.
Ali didn't even see Ulasim leave his place, the man was so fast. He jammed Nawat against the boulder and put a knife to his throat. Nawat twisted, an arm moving. Ulasim went down on his knees. He bent over, gasping, dead white under his coppery skin. Nawat jumped 5 feet in the air to the top of his boulder. 2 long strides took him across the rocks. A short jump put him on a tree branch over Ali's head. Chenaul went to Ulasim.
What did you do? She demanded. If you've killed him!
Nawat smiled at her from his leafy refuge.
I only pecked him with my fingers. He was rude to try to cut me. I will help Ali do whatever she must. He should know that.
All three Raka stared at the young Fletcher.
What are you? Demanded Locage. You aren't Raka.
Isn't he? Ali asked lazily, watching Ulasim and Chenaul through her lowered lashes.
What is he then?
Luaran?
Ulasim straightened with a grimace. He patted Chenaul on the shoulder, reassuring her that he wasn't stabbed, then stared at Nawat. Ignoring him, Nawat picked something off the tree trunk, eyed it, then ate it. His eyebrows shot up. He looked around, found a twig and broke it off, and used it to root in a crevice of the tree bark. Ulasim wiped a hand over dry lips and crouched a little, holding the spot in his side where Nawat had struck him.
Not Luaran,
he said at last, wonder in his eyes and voice. But not Ra'ka either.
Does it matter if I give you warriors the secrets of the crows? Asked Nawat.
He brought his twig close to his face. A grub squirmed on the end of it. He popped it into his mouth and thrust his twig under a new piece of bark.
We have a wager with the Bright One, too, the god of tricks, the crow man explained as he wriggled his twig. To help Ali, we must help the nestlings. Surely it makes no difference what I am. You humans worry about proper names too much.
Chenaol looked at Ali.
Do you vouch for him?
Why not ask your god? Ali demanded in return. The crows were his idea.
Ulasim rubbed his side.
Things were simpler in Rajmuat, he complained.
Nawat, tonight you'll meet with Fezgau and me in the guard barracks. We must work out patrol schedules and decide how your crows will communicate with our fighters. And come down out of that tree. You're making my neck hurt, and your eating habits make my belly squirm.
Nawat jumped to the ground, then found a rock to sit on.
No more knives? He asked Ulasim.
No more pecking? Ulasim retorted.
Nawat looked at Ali.
I cannot teach the Ra'ka as we taught you. We will sort that out.
I leave it in your capable hands, Ali told him with a smile. She looked at the Ra'ka conspirators.
Any other royal spies in the household?
Just Hasui, and she's in the kitchen under my eye,
Chenaol replied with a firm nod.
I prefer not to kill her if it can be helped.
No, don't, Ali said. It'll leave you short-handed in the kitchen. For another, we can send the wrong information through Hasui and Veron to their masters. Knowing who is your spy can be quite useful. She scratched her head, reviewing all the things they had discussed. There were plenty of factors to keep in mind, and she wanted to make sure that they had covered the most important ones. She had always expected her first job as a spy to be a simple matter of watching targets and sending reports on their behavior. Dai would never thrust a green spy into a political swamp like this one for her first assignment. She grinned. She would have a tale to tell him when she went home.
Ulasim was staring at her.
What? She asked. Where did you learn to think this way? The Ra'ka asked slowly.
We would have killed Hasui outright if Chenaol had not said she would be controlled in the kitchen. Killing Veron would break no one's heart. He's too fond of whipping Ra'ka to get them to move. We never would think to make the spies pass on bad information. And it never occurred to us that a castle might be a trap.
Oh, the god fiddled with my mind, she replied wickedly.
They're fond of doing things like that. You never know what they'll get up to.
I do not believe you, Ulasim replied, an amused glint in his dark eyes. No god ever needs to know such tiny things. Who are your people?
Tortalans, Ali informed him. Merchants? Harmless. Unless you count my mother, who was a player.
What of Prince Bronau's people? She asked, changing the subject.
Are any of them more than they seem to be?
The Ra'ka looked at one another and shook their heads.
They just got here, Chenaol reminded Ali.
Ali yawned.
I'll have to look around then. Perhaps Her Grace will excuse me from pouring the wine tonight.
You might want to keep a constant watch on them, too. After all, they might find the weapons hidden in the storerooms under the stable.
Locage cursed eloquently.
You can't know about them. I've got the stables watched all the time.
I didn't know until now, Ali replied easily, enjoying the joke she had just played on the old man.
She ignored Locage's muttered curse, though she stored it in her memory as a useful one to know.
It's a central location, after all, and the Ra'ka linger there all the time.
Ulasim whistled softly.
Our friend picked well when he picked you.
Just don't get used to me, Ali thought as she smiled at him. I don't mean to be here after the autumn equinox.
Chenaol looked at the sun.
I'd best get back, she told them. Those lazy wenches will slack on the cooking if I'm not there.
She set off among the rocks. Ulasim murmured quietly to Locage, then stood aside as the old man mounted his horse as nimbly as a boy. Ali looked around for Nawat. He was nowhere to be seen. Like any crow, he seemed to have the ability to come and go unnoticed, something that didn't involve magic, only animal craft. At last, Ulasim was alone with Ali.
Tomorrow I will send Vijda to you. She and her dogs will graze her herd with yours every day after this. She will tell no one what you do once you have settled the flock. This way, should you need to leave your post, she can look after the goats as well. Ali nodded.
Good idea, I thank you.
Also, what are your preferred weapons? He wanted to know. Can you use any, old child of merchants?
Ali raised an eyebrow at him.
You don't believe what I told you of my family. I'm hurt, maybe even crushed.
Ulasim was unmoved.
She delayed by reminding him. It's my life if I'm caught with weapons, you know that. Slave owners don't arm slaves.
She wasn't sure if it was wise to let anyone know of her skill with knives.
Then you must not be caught, Ulasim replied coolly. Have you been to the shrine between the stable and the wall?
Ali shook her head.
The flagstone before the altar can be lifted. What shall we leave there for you?
He smiled thinly. Ali nibbled her lower lip. It would be nice to have more blades than just the stolen one hidden in her bedroll. She'd always teased her father when he complained about the magic that alerted the king and queen of people carrying hidden weapons. She had liked telling him that he sounded like a child without his favorite blanket. Now she understood his feeling of vulnerability. Like Ali, he could fight hand to hand at need, but daggers were what he loved. He'd taught that love to her.
Daggers? She asked. Good ones, as flat as may be with sleeve and leg sheaths. They would be a blessing.
Merchants, Ulasim remarked dryly, referring to her false background again.
Yes, of course, I believe you. I must, mustn't I? You are Kiprioth's chosen, so the truth drips from your tongue like honey from the comb.
Again you are suspicious, Ali told the Raka, shaking her head in sorrow. You wound me so deeply.
She liked Ulasim. He was smart.
I can see that, retorted Ulasim. Daggers we shall provide you, under the flagstone, tonight.
Ali relaxed, looking at the clouds again, but the Raka was not finished.
And since you are so busy watching the plotters who creep up behind us, I will assign a guard to you. Someone who won't look out of place with the goats.
His voice was firm, his eyes direct as Ali sat up and groaned a protest. Ulasim said firmly,
At the very least, he can run your errands.
Ali sighed.
What about a girl? She asked. Or a woman? Less conspicuous and less likely to stir up gossip.
Ulasim stiffened. Ali made a face at him.
Sarai told me your women fought together with the men in the Raka armies, she said patiently.
It seems reasonable to guess that the Raka who aren't under the Luaran eye continue to train their women to fight. I can understand you're not wanting folk to know. This way the Luaran think the number of Raka who might give them trouble is half of your actual force. But I'm not going to tell, and a female won't be noticed as much as a man.
I will see to it, he said.
He started to go, then turned back to face Ali.
His dark eyes were puzzled. I suppose I must trust the god's opinion of you, but you still worry me. He is a trickster when all is said and done.
But I'm not, Ali assured him, the picture of earnest youth. Why, I'm just as true and honest as dirt, and I'm even more charming than dirt.
Ulasim winced. Thank you for describing yourself in such unforgettable terms, he said. I see you and the god are well matched.
Ali watched him go. Ulasim is their general, she decided, thinking about the roles each Raka played. Lokage is in charge of communications and storage for weapons and supplies. Fezgal must be their war leader, used to straightforward combat, and Chenaol. She plucked a grass stem. She supposed every army needed a chief cook who was quick with her knives, but surely there was more to Chenaol than that. Did she command the women of the Raka? What could she do that the men could not? Ali's memory showed her an image of Chenaol talking to the merchants who stopped by Tener from time to time. She was accepting boxes from them, boxes that Ali had seen open in the kitchen. Knives. No one questioned a Raka cook in the purchase of knives, and it would be easier to smuggle longer blades to a cook than a man-at-arms watched by a Luaran superior. Ali smiled. Chenaol was the Raka armorer. That was why Ulasim has said we when he talked of giving me knives, she thought. He may plant them, but he'll get them from Chenaol. Truly this was a fine morning, Ali reflected as she stretched and thought. Now she had human allies and their resources. With Bronau in residence and the king's disfavor, the Balitang's Luarand and Rakha alike had an excuse to strengthen their defenses. Any of them who had been waiting for some day to come would know that day was nearly upon them. They would be razor-sharp, with no need for Ali to sharpen them, and unlike the crows, they would understand that Bronau might serve as a lightning rod to draw the king's wrath. Ali gnawed a grass stem. The Rakha and the crows were prepared for attack by armed fighters both from within and without. However, they still could not withstand a strong magical attack. Somehow they would have to produce a mage. Once again, Ali brought the goats in early. After they were safely penned, she waved to Nawat, who was fletching arrows near the archery butts, and entered the keep in search of the Duchess. She found the lady in the small bedchamber where Pertran, Elsrin, and their nursemaid slept, giving her son a bath while the maid toweled his sister dry. Ali bowed. "Excuse me, Your Grace," she said. Winamine looked up at her. Her hair had escaped its severe domed style to curl around her face and neck. Her indigo linen gown was water-spotted, and she was flicking drops of water into her gleefully squealing boy's face. "Pemberi," she said to the maid, "would you get some more drying cloths? I fear both Elsrin and I will need them." The maid curtsied. "At once, Your Grace," she murmured. She wrapped Pertran in a cocoon of cloths and trotted from the room. "Your Grace, Hasui, one of the kitchen slaves, will take my place as wine-pourer tonight," Ali murmured in Kiprish. Neither Elsrin nor Pertran spoke it very well, though Dove, Sarai, and their parents did. "There are some things I must do in your service, and I will need to report to you and His Grace later, once the prince has retired." Winamine's eyes sharpened. "You will be careful," she asked, keeping her voice low as she too spoke in Kiprish. "You will take no risks that might endanger us?" Unconsciously she grasped Elsrin's hand in hers. "Your Grace, no one will even know what I did," Ali assured her.
"Mama, why are you talking that way?" demanded Pertran from her corner by the fire. "Only Rakha talks that way."
"But the Rakha are our people too, dear," Winamine told her daughter. "We honor them by learning their tongue. They were here long before our ancestors came."
"But Ali isn't Rakha," the girl pointed out. "She's Luarin."
"She honors our Rakha friends too," Winamine said, absently soaping Elsrin's back.
Ali bowed and left the watery room. She had no interest in explaining the language of conquest to a four-year-old, and knowing Pertran from the journey to Tener, she was aware that the girl would stick to the subject until the end of time, if not muzzled. She retreated to a small closet off the servant's stair and changed into the dark, long-sleeved tunic and leggings she kept hidden there. She had stolen them from the Balitang storehouse back in Rajmuat and hidden them for special occasions. She then wrapped a length of dark cloth around her face and head until only her eyes showed. By the time she finished, the household was assembling for the evening meal. Ali hid in the closet where she kept her prowler's clothing until she heard no footsteps on the servant's stair for a good space of time. Pocketing the lockpicks she also kept there, she emerged carefully and peered into the main hall around the door behind the Balitangs. Hasui, cleaned up and dressed to serve at the dais, poured Bronau a cup of wine as Ali watched. Supper had begun. Quickly, Ali counted the prince's household in the hall. Everyone was present, eating with the duke's servants. Satisfied, Ali climbed the keep stairs, past the floors where the prince, then the Balitang, slept. When she reached the fourth floor, where Bronau's household stayed, she got to work on the servants' trunks, using her picks with care. By the time the first course was over downstairs, she had uncovered 2 royal spies among the prince's servants. She didn't flatter herself that it was her skill that made the discovery so easy. Anyone who searched their baggage would have seen it. Both men carried unusual supplies of paper, as well as the general code book issued for the Isle's lower-level spies. Ali had memorized its contents over a year ago, when it had become the new general code for the Isles. Swiftly but expertly, she checked each nook and cranny on the floor where the servants might have hidden more surprises. That chore done, she padded down to the second level and used her picks to enter the prince's rooms. She searched his 2 men servants' belongings first. They too carried more than their share of writing paper, as well as 1 book. Their volume was The Perfect Servant, a popular book of advice for those who worked in a higher capacity in a house or fiefdom. These men did not report to the crown, however. One of them had already started his next report to his master. Using the faint marks in the book on service, Ali swiftly deciphered the greeting on the document. "To my Lord Rubinyan." She raised an eyebrow. So the crown used Bronow's general servants to spy on him, while his older brother bought the services of Bronow's body servants. What kind of bad feeling existed between these two? She couldn't imagine Alan or Tom hiring anyone to spy on her. Of course, neither of them was eyeing a feeble king's throne. She left the servants' belongings exactly as she had found them and proceeded to Bronow's private writing case. The magic on the lock blazed in her magical sight. The case wouldn't open if she tried the various unlocking words that she knew. There was also no keyhole in the lock, which didn't surprise her. Bronow struck her as the kind of man who was careless with keys, even important ones. He wasn't the sort to fuss with complex things, either. Ali peered more closely at the lock, shifting her sight to read magic. The signs on it turned dark and appeared one at a time, over and over, until she identified what each meant. The case had been locked with an essence spell, the perfect thing for a man who didn't like the bother of keys or details. Fortunately for Ali, she had studied these matters under very fine teachers. An essence spell was quite easy to break once recognized. Ali reached for Bronow's riding gloves, which he had thrown on his bed in his rush to dress for supper. His hurried servants had left them right where a bright girl would find a use for them. Ali took a glove and turned it inside out, then pressed a leather fingertip to the lock. A line appeared through the middle of the device. The lid opened. Carefully, she turned the glove right side out and replaced it in the exact spot she had found it. Her father had drilled her in such habits over the years, during exercises where he would send her out of the room, shift the things in it, then summon her back to replace everything as it had been. When she was little, it was her favorite game. Now it was habit to remember the exact placement of anything she moved. Ali knelt on the floor and raised the box's lid. The first 7 letters inside were addressed to businesses. A draper, a moneylender, a cobbler, a horsecoper, a jeweler, an armorer, and a bowyer. In them, Bronow wrote that he was aware of the sums that were owed to them. Ali leafed through the papers and found the bills he had mentioned. Reading how much he owed to these people, she raised both eyebrows. This man spent more on shoes than Maud did to supply pirate soup with food for a month. Ali paused to listen for outside sounds. Hearing only the faint noise from the great hall, she returned to the letters. Bronow wrote the merchants that his debts would be paid, within the year, with interest, and he swore it by Mithros. He also wrote that they would be well rewarded for their patience. Ali arranged the letters neatly and put them aside with their bills. Prince Bronow seemed very confident he would be able to pay his creditors in full, even the moneylender, and he'd taken the risk of dragging a god's name into it. The receipts all had 4th notice or 5th notice written on them, and the dates covered the last 4 years. How did he intend to pay? Ali wondered. None of Bronow's people had said that he'd snagged himself a very wealthy heiress. From what Ali knew, the money would not come from his brother and sister-in-law. Now he was out of favor with the king, and yet he was strangely confident. These letters were dated 2 days ago. Sarai was no heiress, not the kind that Bronow needed. From the notes on their bills, the prince's creditors were about to haul him before Mithros's altar, where lawyer priests would strip Bronow of all he owned. Ali looked at the next sheet of paper in the box. It was covered with scratch-outs and rephrasings. It seemed to be a letter to an old friend chatting of this and that. Ali read it over twice, eyed the scratched-out words, and nearly groaned aloud. The letter was in the most simple-minded code in existence, the very first code she had memorized. It was based on the Book of Mithros. Nearly every household in the eastern and southern lands had a copy, even if the residents took some other god as the center of their belief. "Duke Zeberon," she translated, "though you are both on the royal council, I have reason to know that you are no friend to my brother R. We might find common ground between us, with the end in mind of ousting R from his position." That was as far as Bronow had written. The rest of the box held empty paper and the Book of Mithros, but Ali checked it all just to be sure. There were no other signs of code or magic. Carefully, she replaced everything as she had found it. After a double check of the room to make sure it looked as it had when she broke in, she left by the servant's stair, changed into her normal homespun tunic and leggings, and walked into the kitchen. The prince has given me plenty to think about, she thought, scrounging leftovers. As soon as the house is quiet, I'll make sure the Duke and Duchess are thinking, too. Ollie was dozing by the kitchen fire as the staff began to carry the dishes out for washing. Pemberi woke her with the message that their graces had errands for her. Ollie grumbled a reply and trudged up the servant's stair once again. The Duke and Duchess awaited her in the sitting room of their new quarters. To Ollie's surprise and discomfort, Sarai occupied the chair next to her father. The older Balitongs correctly read the rigid set of Ali's body. Sarai is of age, the Duke said gravely. She will have to learn these things to survive. We have already told her of the god's message to us. Ali pressed her lips together. The more who know, the more you risk, was a motto she'd memorized practically in her cradle. Still, Sarai was Ali's own age. That had to be old enough to be told there were mysteries afoot. Resigned, Ali swept the room with her sight, wondering if Mequen and Winamine had thought the thing all the way through. As she suspected, she caught a flicker of movement in the gap between the door to the main stair and the floor. Immediately, she heightened her magical ability to see color and detail and identified the eavesdropper. She crossed the room silently and yanked the door open. Dove stumbled into the room and almost fell. Ali caught her by one thin arm. The Duchess started from her chair, then settled back into it, biting her lower lip. Mequen scowled at his daughter.
Dove Seri, it is most common of all behaviors to listen at doors, he told her. As a lady, such coarseness is beneath you.
As she covered the crack under the door with a carpet and stuffed a cloth scrap from the Duchess's sewing basket into the keyhole, Ali glanced at Dove to see the effect of the Duke's words. Dove looked at Ali and rolled her eyes, then went to stand before her father.
You told me curiosity was healthy, she said. Is that confined only to books and nature?
Sarai would just have told me anyway. I'd have made her.
As if you could, her older sister snapped.
Ali ignored their debate as she filled in the cracks under the remaining doors and plugged their keyholes as well. Just to be on the safe side in case one of the spies who had come with Bronau had the nerve to dangle on a rope outside the window, she closed and barred the shutters. When she finished, the discussion was over. Dove wore a tiny smile of satisfaction as she pulled up a chair next to Sarai.
Are you ready? Ali inquired.
The Duke nodded. Ali said,
I searched the belongings of the prince and his servants tonight, she informed her listeners.
Mequen frowned.
Your Grace? Ali inquired.
I'm not sure I approve, he replied quietly. He is a friend, a guest in my house. He is entitled to his privacy.
Ali caught the glance traded by Sarai and Dove, one that showed exasperation over their father's unbending good manners. The Duchess showed only concentration as she seemed to focus on the neat stitches she set in her sewing. Ali thought the Duke's scruples were sweet, if unrealistic. Da had always told her that noble honor hindered those who had it as much as it helped them.
Your Grace is an honorable man, and I respect that. However, I am charged with the safety of you and your family. Honor of the type you describe is a luxury.
Before he could order her never to do so again, she held up a hand.
Before you speak, Your Grace, you should know that the prince already enjoys no privacy whatsoever. His attendants include crown spies. His body servants are both in his brother's pay.
Rubinian? Whispered the Duke.
He gripped the arms of his chair with white-knuckled hands.
Ridiculous! He would no more spy. Rubinian is as much my friend as Bronau. He is a good man. They don't get on, but it is temperament, not politics.
Unless you're connected to the royal family and the court, Winamine pointed out, keeping her voice low, then politics and temperament are never separated.
I cannot believe it, repeated the Duke. I will not believe it.
At least he knows the difference between cannot and will not, thought Ali.
Would Your Grace like proof of what I say? She asked.
Da had warned her that sometimes people refused to believe even when evidence was waved under their noses, but she thought she should offer. Mequen shot her a startled look.
Ali, no, of course not. You are the god's messenger. You would not lie.
I would if I thought it was for your own good, Ali thought as Weenamin patted her husband's arm.
This might be Imogene's influence, the Duchess murmured. She has seen so many conspiracies in her own family that she would suspect them of anyone. Wouldn't you, growing up as His Majesty's daughter?
True, true, whispered the Duke. But Ali could see his eyes. Mequon was too intelligent not to see that it was sensible for someone near the throne, like Rubinyan, to watch a powerful, charming fellow courtier, even if that courtier was his own brother. The Duke also had to be thinking that if Prince Rubinyan suspected his brother, he might suspect anyone, including Mequen himself.
Why am I surprised? He asked and sighed. That is the way of things at court. Everyone spies on everyone else.
Ali could see that the Duke understood her.
No wonder Da prefers to work with clever people, she thought.
They can work out the obvious without openly speaking of it.
She said, There's more, Your Grace. I took the liberty of going through the prince's writing case.
Ali! Cried the Duke, shocked.
Weenamin hurriedly put a finger over her husband's lips to remind him to keep his voice down. The Duke tightened his mouth, then leaned forward and fixed Ali with his sharp brown eyes.
Nobles do not read one another's mail.
I would not know, Your Grace, replied Ali smoothly. I was a servant. Now I am a slave. It's a matter of survival for us to know what our masters know.
I don't believe I noticed before, but you have perfect grammar, remarked Dove. Isn't that odd for a slave who was once a maid?
The god chose me for my skills at mimicry, my lady, Ali replied. That was not a lie at all, she virtuously told herself.
I take it you found something in Prince Bronow's case, or you would not have raised the subject, Weenamin said. Ali nodded.
His Highness is greatly in debt, she told them.
The Duke batted this aside with an impatient hand.
He is always in debt. Really, Ali, if you waste your time with small follies.
She named the sum she had added from the receipts, stopping the Duke in mid-sentence. The Duchess went pale. Sarai gasped. At last the Duchess said,
He'll spend the rest of his life repaying that.
He says not, Your Grace. Ali then told him of the letters he had written but not yet sent, letters to his creditors that promised repayment within a year. She then repeated the contents of the partial letter to Duke Zeberon, offering an alliance against Rubinyan.
Papa, whatever it is, I'm sure he can explain, Sarai said hurriedly, anxiety in her eyes. Perhaps he believes Rubinyan doesn't trust him. Perhaps he just wants to make sure he has friends, in case Imogene ever turns the king against him. It's just more of that jockeying for power you always say goes on at court.
And the money? Asked the Duchess, inspecting her sewing.
He must have an heiress he's courting, whispered Sarai, looking down at her lap. Perhaps Lady Tianan. She's come out of mourning, and the He and Jai family wants to marry into the nobility. No one will mind a merchant wife, not if she's married to someone as popular as Bronow is.
A tear rolled down her cheek and spotted her gold velvet lap. Ali, pretending not to notice that Sarai wept, asked the Duchess if she had messages for her to carry. Her task was done. She had reported what she had learned, and unless they asked her opinion, they had to decide for themselves what to do with that information. She had no opinions of her own, so she wouldn't try to influence their thinking. Bronow was still a threat. She did make a mental note of the fact that if she wanted to influence Mequen at some point, she could appeal to his honor, just as she could appeal to Sarai's love of adventure and excitement. Weenamin dismissed her. As Ali pulled the carpet back into place and removed the cloth from the main door's keyhole, she glanced back at the silent Dove. The girl was sketching the carved whorls in the arm of her chair with a finger, her brow wrinkled, deep in thought. Ali saw no distress on that small face. Only calculation.
It's those who are overlooked by the folk around them you want to watch. They see more than they tell, and they think more than they talk. You want them for your friend. You don't want them asking questions about you.
From a letter to Ali from her father when she was 9. Chapter 9. Learning the Ground. In the morning, Ali visited the shrine between the stable and the wall. There, under the promised flagstone, she discovered 6 knives, all of a finer make than her stolen one. Chenaol knows how to pick a blade, she thought admiringly as she tested them on the fraying hem of her undyed goatherd's tunic. One, as long as her middle finger in the blade, and wickedly sharp, had a sheath that hung by a cord. When she put it over her head, the knife and sheath slipped between her breasts under the band she wore. All that showed above her tunic collar was the kind of cord from which might hang a religious pendant of some kind. 2 perfectly flat knives fit in sheaths under her leggings so well that they barely left a mark on the cloth over them. 2 more flat knives and their sheaths went under the sleeves of her tunic. The most substantial she could wear in her waistband at her back, or carry it with her lunch and water bottle. She put it into that bag and moved one of her leg knives up under her waistband at the middle of her back, where she could reach it in a hurry. The Ra'ka conspirators had revealed more with this gift of weaponry than perhaps they intended her to know. They were desperate for help. They knew they were unused to the world of armies, spies, and nobles. The god's gift of Ali must have seemed like the answer to their prayers. "It's not fair, you getting their hopes up when you know I'll be gone in the fall," she muttered to Kiprioth as she collected her goats. The god chose not to reply. Ali shook her head. Perhaps before she left she could teach the Ra'ka the potential dangers of any move they might try against the king. She led her animals out of the castle walls. Ali and her flock were halfway through the village when the little shepherd girl, Vijda, joined her along with her sheep and the boy who had summoned Ali to Tanair the day before. "Aunt Chenaur says we're to graze with you," the girl confided, waving to the baker as they passed. "And if you're called off sudden, me and Ekit," she jerked a thumb at the boy who stuck his tongue out at her, "we'll take both flocks. Well, me and Ekit and Grace and Arak," she added, naming the shaggy herd dogs. "Aunt Chenaul says you're doing important work for the one who has promised, and we should help you." Ali halted and stopped the girl. Bending down, she drew Ekit over so that he could hear as well as she whispered, "Never repeat that, either of you, all right? Not to anyone, even if you hear others talking about me, not even if your friends say it. For that matter, if the one who is promised means who I think it does, you must never speak of her that way again. Never let on that you know more than what you need to know to herd animals, understand?" Vijda scowled. "I know that," she said crossly. "Great Aunt Chenaul made us promise, but you already know." Ali sighed. "Look, the fewer times you say anything aloud, the better your chances that no one will hear you as shouldn't. Understand? Enemies can't report what they didn't overhear. Now, what shall we talk about?" "Sheep? Goats?" Vijda replied brightly. "Dogs?" added Ekit. Ali grinned at them. "Better." With a wave to the town men who stood morning watch on the gate, they passed out of the village and onto the dusty road. Vijda began to skip, Ekit to run with one of the dogs.
"I love summertime," Vijda told Ali. "All the bees and the flowers and the sun, and no one to stop us from running."
She raced ahead gleefully, trying to catch Ekit, her bare brown feet thumping against the road. The sheep, resigned, picked up their trot along with the goats. Ali shook her head, smiling, then ran to catch up with the children. Their little group settled among boulders. The goats ate grasses tucked between stones, while the sheep grazed on more level ground just below. The dogs placed themselves where they would spot a stray the moment it wandered off from its fellows. Once the animals had settled, Vijda and Ekit removed hand spindles from their packs and clumps of wool combed and rolled for spinning. As Ali climbed higher into the rocks to get a more commanding view of their surroundings, the boy and the girl began the painstaking work of spinning thread, just like the children who minded flocks throughout Tortal. Ali had finished her breakfast when she heard the thump of bare feet on the rock just behind her. Resting a hand on her leg knife, she looked back. Nawat crouched on the rock, smiling at her. "Would you like a grub?" he asked, offering a plump one. "I got it just for you." Ali struggled to think of a diplomatic reply. "We humans don't eat grubs." Remembering stories she'd heard from some of her father's agents, she added, "Not when we don't have to." "But these are juicy and filling," Nawat assured her. "I saved the best of them." Ali gulped. Her breakfast bread and cheese rolled in her belly. Let the grub live to make more grubs, she suggested. Nawat sighed. It is hard to mate feed someone who will not eat. Ali leaned back and looked at the sky. A winged horse soared overhead, flying, it seemed, for the sheer joy of it. We're not to the mate-feeding stage, she informed Nawat lazily. We barely know each other. What if I filled my mouth pouch and spilled it for you? Nawat asked. Would you take food that way? I would lose food that way. I'd throw it up, Ali retorted, amused and nauseated at the same time. Aren't you supposed to be making arrows? I'm supposed to be finding goose feathers, he said comfortably, apparently unhurt by her refusal of his offer. But my friends are getting them for me so I may see you. He reached over and ran his fingers through Ali's hair. None of the other human females are so easy to preen. The movement of his hand was soothing. Are you preening other females? Ali asked, warm in the sun. Only little ones, for practice, Nawat explained. The old ones chitter, giggle, and bounce if I try. It's annoying. You don't giggle and bounce. I like that. You keep trying to preen the ones who giggle and bounce, and you might find yourself preening one of them for the rest of your life, Ali teased. Their fathers and uncles and brothers will see to that. Humans do strange things, Nawat told her with a sigh. I must go soon. My brethren call that they have my feathers. Ali strained to hear, but Nawat's ears were better than hers. She heard only goats, sheep, and Vijta's humming. The Raka did as they told you they would, Nawat continued. Yesterday, their warriors began to leave the villages here. They took horses, food, shelters. Some moved into the forest at Pohan, others into the woods and cliffs outside the village of Inti. More rove the fields. 15 made their camp a mile on the other side of the road, in the rocks. They will keep watch for those who come through the mountains. Most of these were words and concepts Ali had taught the crows in their dream lessons. One was not. How can you tell they are Raka? She asked. Perhaps he had gotten the idea that Raka meant human. Am I Raka? Nawat shook his head. Crows know the Raka, he said. They are our people. Time long past, when the first nest had given birth to the first flocks, Sky, our goddess, laid green eggs in her nest. The Dawn Crow, her mate, and our god was very confused. They hatched to become our brothers and sisters, the Raka. In time, they stopped hearing the voices of Sky and the Dawn Crow, and turned to Kiprioth to serve, but they never forgot their brothers and sisters, the crows. Ali shook her head. I had no idea. I'm glad to know the patrols are out, though. Nawat smiled. I knew you would want to know they do as they say. They respect tricks you will do for them. Ali sat up to protest that she did not do tricks, but Nawat was clambering down through the rocks to the road. Crows flew in from the east, circling him. He was nearly gone from Ali's view when they began to rain feathers down on his head. Ali leaned back on her rock to think without success. All her mind would produce for her was the memory of Nawat's fingers as they passed softly through her inch-long hair, and a repeating thought, "This place gets stranger every day." Sometime later she heard the distant thud of hooves. She sat up. A party trotted by on the road below, trailed by guards. Prince Bronow rode with his hosts again, or rather, with Mequin, Sarai, Dove, and their guards. They were almost gone from sight when the prince and Sarai broke into a gallop, riding hard down the strip of empty earth. Ali propped herself on her elbows. Apparently Sarai had recovered from her unhappiness over the possibility that the prince was looking for a rich wife. It was either that, or the prince had flirted enough to make her forget. Ali shook her head. She hoped Sarai wasn't too infatuated with Bronow. Ali's instincts shrieked that the prince was trouble looking for a place to happen. She did not want it to happen on her watch. Once they were gone, Ali slid to the ground. What was the good of having knives if she was too out of shape to use them? She needed to exercise and to keep exercising. When she found a level patch of grass, she began her stretch routine, loosening all of her muscles, a group at a time. She followed those with routines for hand-to-hand combat. Punches, kicks, pivots, leg sweeps, blocks, elbow and palm strikes, tucks and rolls. She was lost in it, feeling her muscles warm up and loosen when a crow nearby gave the call that meant friend. Ali looked around, wary and waiting. A tall Rakha woman moved out of the shadow between two large boulders. Crossing her hands, Ali gripped her wrists, ready to release the straps that secured her knives. "Good morning," she said pleasantly in Kiprish, every nerve of her body quivering despite her relaxed appearance. "I don't believe we've been introduced." The woman leaned on the 6-foot-long staff she carried. "I am Junaid Dodeka, daughter of Ulasim Dodeka. I am here at my father's request, to keep you alive." Ali inspected the newcomer. Junaid was 4 inches taller than Ali and lean, covered with wiry muscle. Her cheekbones were sharp enough to cut with, her nose the same shape as Ulasim's. She wore her straight black hair braided and pinned tightly down. She dressed in a faded olive-green tunic and loose brown breeches. Her feet were bare. This woman was clearly a fighter. There were knife scars on her hands and arm muscles and on her right cheekbone. Dagger sheaths made lines against the cloth of her breeches and waistband. She also wore leather and metal wrist guards and a leather band around her neck, a rough guard against a knife to the throat. "I don't know how much a stick is going to do as a weapon," Ali remarked casually. Junai spun the staff until it was level, then twisted the hand grip at the center. Blades 12 inches long sprang from each end of the staff, turning it into a double-ended spear. "Well," Ali said, raising her brows, "of course, that is a very different matter." She looked at the older woman. She was in her middle 20s, Ali guessed, and decided to try a theory she had in mind. "I don't suppose you know of any mages we might recruit." Junai took a step back. "What makes you believe there is a mage here, Luaren, or that I would know of such a one?" Ali leaned against a tree and thrust her hands into her breeches pockets. "My gracious, why ever would I think such a thing?" she asked, batting her eyes as she clasped her hands under her chin. "Well, let's see. We're attacked by bandits just on the other side of the mountains. We brought some with us, did you know? They're sweet in a starveling way. Yet here we are on this lovely flat plateau with thriving farms and Rakha who aren't nearly so ragged and thin as most of the ones who watched us come here. Tener is just a fat goose ready for the plucking, yet no one speaks of bandits. Ever. No one mentions raids in the past or patrols. Your father had to be nudged into setting patrols out in the open lands to look for royal soldiers or assassins. Back home, bandits huddle in isolated places, waiting to make their fortunes by taking them from others. Oh, wait, I forgot. There are no bandits at home where a strong mage is to be found. Did I miss anything?" Junai stopped leaning on her spear and began to spin it, hand over hand, casually. "Father was right. You are clever. So take my advice. Don't ask about our mage. She hates Luaren. She'll burn your face off if you come near her. Doubtless I would perish in your defense. There are ways to live without mages. You have the gods' favor, I am told. It will serve you better than she will."
Ali rubbed her nose and looked Junai over.
"So if this mage sees to the bandits, how am I to have faith in your ability to protect me? I'd think your only fighting practice would be from mock battles with people you've known all your life."
Junai bared teeth in a menacing grin.
"I was a caravan guard for 7 years," she informed Ali. "You want to try me?"
"No," Ali said, waving an arm in dismissal. "I'll take your word for it." She let the conversation end. Junai had told her more than she had planned to. Certainly she had not meant to agree that a mage lived on the Tener lands, but that much she had done openly. She had also told Ali that her orders to guard Ali's life were more important than her fear of the mage. The mage was Rakha, probably a full-blood, if she hated Luaren with such unmixed passion. And since Pohan village was notorious for its hate of Luaren, chances were the mage lived there. Ali had scouting to do then, before she approached this mage herself. Ali went back to her exercises. The sun was almost directly overhead when the riding party returned to the castle. Ali heard the beat of their horses' hooves as she searched for a stray kid among the rocks. When she found the youngster and returned him to his mother, she discovered that one of the riders and her bodyguard had come to join her. A horse idly cropped grass where Ali had set her knife-throwing targets. A guard lingered near Vijda and Ekit, talking with the children. There was no sign of Junai, but Ali guessed that the